Know what that sound is, I bet. That's a grouse drumming. And it's the perfect way to start our show today because we are talking about grouse, talking about waterfowl season, and a whole lot more with our two guests as we look at the wonderful world of wildlife with Jamie Nack and Scott Craven. Hi, Larry Mealer here. Thanks for joining us today. Jamie, good to see you.
Hey, always fun to be here.
She is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Scott Craven with us, too. Scott, hi.
Hello, Larry.
He is an emeritus. Yeah, good to see you. He's an emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist from that same department. We have lots to talk about today, and certainly welcome your wildlife questions as we move along. So I hope you'll join in the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, grouse, heard that grouse drumming. Jamie, there's a DNR comment section coming up about
grouse. Yeah, a couple of interesting things to talk about from the rough grouse standpoint. So first of all, the breeding survey data has come out. So that is the drumming that you just heard opening the show, but the drumming counts. And it appears that statewide drumming activity has increased 41% between data from 2018 and 2019. And should be noted, this is trend information, right? Gives us a trend of how the population is doing. And central part and northern Wisconsin are typical habitats for the rough grouse. And in both areas, those population or those surveyed data has increased over last year. If you recall, going back a year, we saw an unexpected drop in the population. So grouse are cyclic and typically run on a 10-year cycle. And it's typically years that end in 9 or 0 where we see them at their peak. So last year at this time when we saw a lower survey, it was a little bit concerning leading into the harvest season. So looks like we're back on track. Will we ever know what happened with that dip there? probably not with certainty, but it looks promising for this fall. And then just to touch on the state is continuing a three-state partnership with Minnesota and Michigan to test birds for West Nile virus. And so hunters who are interested in receiving a test kit that they can do in the field and submit for testing should reach out to their county wildlife biologist to get a few kits that they can then submit some blood and some feathers from their harvest so that we can look a little bit about the what percent have West Nile virus or, you know, show the titer for that.
Are they free or is it what?
Yep, the test kits are free. And for anybody who is still retaining a test kit from last year that they didn't use it, that test kit is still good and can be used for this year as well. And we are still waiting to hear, at least I haven't seen it published, the results of, I believe there was about 240 samples last year during the hunting season. And they were expecting sometime this summer to get those results back and see where we're at.
I imagine Scott still has all his test kits because it's hard to hit those grouse.
They ran out of test kits in my area. And people shouldn't be discouraged with those test kits. The collection is just a little bit of blood, a few feathers, and the heart. And so it's an easy thing to do. But in addition to the test kit, anybody who finds a dead grouse, maybe one hits the window, they find one flopping around in the backyard that seems emaciated or whatever, anyone can contribute by collecting those birds, bagging them, and getting them to the wildlife manager in a prompt fashion so the samples don't deteriorate. So everybody can pitch in and help, and it's a good thing to do, hopefully to eliminate West Nile as a big factor in these ups and downs.
And that's one of the – and just to be sure on this, do you – let's say I have a hunting license, but somebody else may not have a hunting license and they – a grouse runs into their window, or is it okay to grab that grouse?
Well, that particular grouse would not necessarily. So if you see a sicker emaciated grouse, then they would be interested in collecting that for testing. Again, I would reach out to your county wildlife biologist through the DNR. A window collision is a little bit different situation. Yeah. there are places that can take those in as under a salvage permit, like us at the university. We can take in birds that have collided with a window or even roadkill and use them for our teaching collection under permit. But that one wouldn't be likely to be a suspect for West Nile virus based on the way it passed. You typically will see it be emaciated, the ones that have that. And then I was just going to mention the third thing that's exciting with grouse is, you know, through some of this concern, and we even reduced the length of the grouse season last fall, we've also, the state, the Department of Natural Resources and partners, including the tribes and the Ruffed Grouse Society and so on, are working together to put together a rough grouse management plan for the state, which we've not had before. So the public is able to comment on that plan. It should be on the website now and will be there through August 26th. There are also going to be a number of sessions, primarily in northern Wisconsin and in grouse habitat, three in-person sessions where folks can review the plan and then comment on the management plan. So again, this is for management and also what research needs we have for grouse.
So you go to the DNR website?
DNR website, type in rough grouse. It's all over their webpage right now. So.
And you can comment without having to be at a session.
You can also submit comments.
So great information there. What about waterfowl?
Yeah, so additionally, the waterfowl survey results have come out, and that is the breeding population survey. They're conducted about the middle of May. Those are aerial transects that are run, and they follow a specific protocol. The state of Wisconsin has been doing those for 46 consecutive years, so we have, again, trend data over time.
Yeah.
So we can get an idea of how we compare to the previous year, but then over 46 years, what is the trend? And so for the total breeding duck population, we're down about 6% from the 2018 estimate. And when we look over the 46 years, we're 3% down that long term. So slight dip, nothing drastic. And then from the Canada goose standpoint, quite a bit the other way. 9% increase from last year. And from a 46-year mean average, we're 71% above the long-term mean.
Wow.
So geese are doing quite well.
Scott, I got another call for you to identify. Dave Poltratz is probably ready to pull it up. That's a great call, isn't it?
It's a great call, and it seems like an unlikely source once you know what it is. But anyway, that's an elk, a male elk bugling, a bull elk bugling, and it's a neat sound. Pretty restricted here in Wisconsin, but people are working on making it a little more widespread. But it's certainly a common thing to hear in the western United States.
What's going on with our population of elk? Is it
I think it's mostly good news. There are, at least the last I heard, still 60 plus animals. You'd think we could count them in the corral, except births and other things have changed the numbers a little bit over time. But there is somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 animals still in quarantine, ready to be released. And I think they'll be used this year to augment the Clam Lake herd, and that'll push that original herd up pretty close to 300 animals. That's the herd that is now available for hunting, and the permits have been drawn for this year, and the five lucky winners of the drawing announced. So that'll take place coming up before too long. But this marks the final year of the cooperative program with the state of Kentucky, whereby these elk have been trapped in Kentucky, moved up to Wisconsin, both to augment the original herd and start the second herd down in the Black River Falls area. So,
That sound both, is really something to hear, isn't it?
Hopefully those animals will persist, the herds will grow, and more people will get a chance to hear that because it is a cool thing.
Jim in Larson has a question or a comment, I think. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guys. I spent a couple hours yesterday looking at the rough grouse management plan, and I wanted to point out that it's still in draft form yet. It really hasn't been finalized. One of the major deficiencies that I've noted, and this will be actually submitted through the Wildlife Work Group of Wisconsin's Greenfire is that the results of last year's rather extensive hunter survey for grouse is not included in that plan. So I'm really anxious to see the full-fledged results of that coming out and see what that sort of impacts upon the draft management plan. With regard to Jamie's back-on-track comment regarding the rough grouse cycle or population, I'd say that she's really only half right, or this is a half true statement, because while we know that the number of the drumming crown, particularly in northern Wisconsin, has gone up by 41%, we really don't know what the brood surveys are showing yet, and that won't actually take place until I think sometime this month. So we really don't know whether or not we're back on track in terms of the population or not, and we won't know for a bit. And finally, with regard to the Kateskets, I can tell you that the way those test kits are actually turned back into the DNR can be a real problem, because I hunt in Iron County. That's where my cabin is. Last year, the test kit was completed, and I believe it has to be picked up by either FedEx or UPS. And where my cabin is, and it has to be picked up within a number of hours of actually being completed, I had a real hard time getting FedEx or UPS to actually pick up that kit. It can't be sent back through the mail, the U.S. mail, which I find absolutely kind of astounding, because that would be the normal way one would expect to be able to return those things. My comments.
All right, Jim, thanks so much. Jamie, let's go to you.
Sure. Jim, you're absolutely correct. When I referred to kind of back on track, just in terms of the breeding survey data, seems to more align with that 10-year cycle. But you're right, there's additional surveys and also what comes of the fall harvest that we'll need to wait and look at. And I think that's part of the West Nile virus testing, too, is to get some answers with that information. I can't really comment on the testing. I'm not sure what the procedures are or how quickly they need to get
the data.
Feathers
wouldn't make any difference. Maybe it's the blood.
Yeah.
Well, yes, they're very concerned about the samples deteriorating with the test kits as well as with dead birds that might be submitted. But
sure.
If anybody, there's a bit of a commitment of effort involved here. So someone who's serious about participating, the information came out on the DNR's weekly news bulletin and is available on the DNR website, and it's very specific about that. And I think the best approach for a group of hunters, if they've got some test kits, is to get a volunteer and get them to the county wildlife manager. You know, our counties aren't that large that someone's not going to be within reach of an office and try and get them in there. But verify first how much time you have. And I think in the case of the dead birds, they specify that if you can't get it there in time, they can be refrigerated or frozen, and there's some time involved there. That it stretches your available window a little bit. So if you're going to go to the trouble to get the kit, collect the samples, take a little extra time to make sure you know and have a plan in mind for getting the samples submitted in a timely fashion.
Yeah, Jim raised some good points there, for sure.
Well, that's the nice thing, too, to know that people are spending time. That's why there are draft plans. So people who have a vested interest, are knowledgeable, whatever, can spend a little time with the plan, and then that feedback makes the plan better. That's why they do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking with Scott Craven and Jamie Nack today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Scott's an emeritus there. Jamie, the Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife today with our guest experts, Scott Craven and Jamie Nack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, experiences to share, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us your questions, and maybe you got a nice wildlife photo. We always love to see those, too, at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Cole in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Cole.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question for your guests. I was wondering if they had any advice for anyone that wanted to get into grouse hunting and hasn't done it before.
Yeah.
Well, Price County is the grouse capital of the world, so we've got folks traveling. I mean, it's pretty big in terms of tourism, folks traveling from around the country to come into that part of Wisconsin to hunt, you are looking for a specific age class of forest. So typically young forest, I'm sure there'll be folks that will chime in and give their opinion of that. But typically, if you were to put your index fingers together and your thumb and make a circle, as the trees get larger than that, you're probably into mature of an age class to be finding
a
quantity of grouse, right? And especially if you want to hunt woodcock as well, then you're looking for, you know, moister areas. But you're looking for young aspen. One way to attempt to find that is to talk to the local forester and find out where some of the timber harvests have been going on in the past few years. There's also, is it F-Flight through DNR that has a map of public lands for hunting? And I would do some exploration on the DNR's website to get at, I believe it covered game birds. And
I'd add the Ruffed Grouse Society.
And the Ruffed Grouse Society would help with in terms of like what habitat requirements you're looking for. But the local wildlife biologist, the local forester can be of help. And again, some of these mapping tools that are on the Department of Natural Resources website.
Mm-hmm. The Forest Service also publishes maps of what's been cut on the national forests over time so that people can plot out their attack. But I think the best news for our would-be grouse hunter is that most of these grouse are in the northern third of the state. That's where the counts are up. That's where the best habitat is. And there's a lot of public land. You know, unlike someone saying, "Ooh, I'd like to learn how to hunt pheasants in the southern part of the state," where there's not a lot of public land, you're relegated to a few public hunting grounds. In the North Woods, you can wander over huge expanses of forest. The other good news is, while a dog enhances the experience, you can hunt grouse without a dog, effectively. And that, coupled with getting involved in a local chapter event of the Ruffed Grouse Society, as was pointed out, and getting to know some folks who might at least point you in the right direction of the various types of hunting, it's, I think, one of the easiest to get started in because of the public land. And really, in terms of equipment, orange hat, a hunting vest, and a shotgun, and you're off and running. So
And a lot of ammunition.
And a license.
And a license. That'd be good, too.
License.
Yeah, then it comes hitting the birds.
Yeah.
But I like the Ruffed Grouse Society idea, the local chapter, because you're going to meet some people who already hunt grouse. And most hunters are willing to give you some good advice. They may not give you the best spot in the world that they like to go to every time, but they're certainly going to talk with you about grouse hunting.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
Let's take another call. Bill in Bayfield. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Hey, a couple quick comments and or questions on the grouse and the elk. I'll start with the grouse. I hunt a lot in Bayfield County, and I was going to talk about the prescribed burns and who's in charge of those and why they do it in the spring. This goes along with the grouse and the sharptail populations. They do it in the spring, especially in the Barrens area or in the bird sanctuary in Solon Springs. The issue I have is that they do it in the spring and they're chilling out the broodstock.
Oh.
The other one I have and the other one I have is about the elk. Is if there's any questions or issues on or talks about getting them out of the swamps of Clam Lake, because I don't know if you look at any species or subspecies of elk across the country, there's no subspecies or subspecies that primarily lives in a swamp area. They like higher ground, they like open areas, and there's a little bit in Clam Lake because of the old elk site, but not near enough to sustain a population. And also the human impact and human disturbance with the goings-on of the elk down there, because there's a That's a huge stress thing.
Well, I'll start with the prescribed burn, and Scott can handle the elk questions, or we'll tag team on both. So the prescribed burning, I understand the concern about, you know, why do you burn in the spring, and are you removing habitat that the nesting birds, whether it be grassland birds, which are a species I worked on for my master's work, or ducks in the prairies, or the grouse that you mentioned. And so you're doing it early enough with the idea that there is some regeneration coming, and you're not, you know, you're only dealing with adult birds that can leave the area on their own. You're not burning in June when they have nests and nestlings on the ground or chicks on the ground. And then additionally, when wildlife managers, whether that be state or federal or tribal, when they're planning for their prescribed burns on the properties that they manage, they're looking at a couple of units per year. They're not burning all of their areas at one time. So there's a rotational plan that goes in place. So they're not, so there are other properties available for these birds to nest and to reproduce.
All right. And Scott, comment on the elk in the swamps and so forth.
I'm not that, I've been over there a few times to look around, and I just don't recall it as being excessively swampy, nor is very much of the North Woods. I think a great deal of thought went into back in 95 when those elk were first restored with the Michigan elk. There was a great deal of thought into finding a site that had suitable habitat, human densities conducive to the elk getting around, even though admittedly there are problems with road kills and assorted other things, and that the habitat was suitable. And they settled on Clam Lake, and the herd has been doing fairly well. And I think that's actually a non-issue. And let's leave it at that.
All right. Thanks again, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another Bayfield caller. Judy, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, this is Judy. I'm calling from Bayfield, and I'm answering Scott. I'm talking to Scott and all of you. We collected or had dropped off on our doorstep window-killed birds or road-killed birds and saved them to create study skins for River Edge. And sometimes they got saved for a long time in our freezer. Mm-hmm. And after a while, the rule was the birds no longer go in the freezer in plastic bags, but in paper bags, because I did not enjoy opening the freezer and seeing these birds looking back at me.
Okay. Well, I guess that's just a personal tolerance level, I guess. I personally prefer the clear plastic bags when I'm freezing specimens, because I can see what the heck is in there. If the if I forgot to use an indelible Sharpie and all of a sudden the writing's gone, hey, what's in this? And I'm looking for a hamburger patty for dinner, but instead it's a it's a roadkill specimen that I've got to get to the museum. So I think that in terms of saving the specimens, this gets into the notion of what the legality issue that came up earlier. Generally, the rule of thumb when people were calling me about specimens and I talked to the wardens was that you kind of got a 24-hour grace period when, if you pick up something protected like a hawk on the side of the road and in an incredible level of misfortune you bump into a warden on the way home with it, at that point, you say, hey, I just picked this up down on Route 25, and I'm taking it to River Edge or Bay Beach or the Schlitz Audubon or whatever, that it's a virtual certainty. Okay, fine, get it to them quickly, but you can't possess this as an individual. All well and good. If you start stockpiling such specimens in your freezer, I think you run into potential difficulty. A low probability, but still potential difficulty. And the longer the specimens are in the freezer, the harder they are to prepare, because they become more difficult to skin and so on. But for someone who knows what they're doing, and usually if you wrap them in a damp rag or cloth or whatever tightly and then seal them up, they'll keep for a while in the freezer as a potentially valuable specimen. But you've got to know that the people who are accepting them have someone who can actually prepare them and get them into the collection. Otherwise, it's a lot of effort for naught.
And this kind of reminds me about your efforts in the taxidermy area. Scott, you have become quite active in this area.
somewhat unwittingly, but you recall, we bring this up periodically, but it must be 3 or 4 years ago now, we talked about this, and I was trying to broker places in Wisconsin, like the aforementioned nature centers, that were interested in specimens but having a hard time finding them, and match them up with people who had mounted birds, mammals, whatever, at home, left over from grandpa's hunting collection or whatever the source was. And that worked okay for a little while, and then things interest died off after a month or two. But then all of a sudden, somehow that program found its way onto the internet, and somehow over the last year or so, there's not a week that goes by that I don't have someone contact me about a collection somewhere in the country, not just in Wisconsin, but in the country. Currently sitting at home in my file, I've got a collection of African big game in Las Vegas, a collection of trophies housed in Miami, over 500 specimens in a climate-controlled warehouse, a shark in Michigan, and on and on and on. And I've been in contact with the Society for the Protection of Natural History Collections, which is an international group, and finding places that will take these huge collections is borderline impossible because of the space and the curatorial needs. So I'm currently placing things around. I found a couple folks who are interested in specimens just in the last week. I'm going to Milwaukee Friday to pick up two collections and get those moved around. So I would offer up, if there are nature centers or educational institutions who are
schools,
still
maybe
schools, anyone who can legally possess the materials and needs them for whatever purpose, you know, contact me and I'll let you know either what I have or what I can get. The problem is this has a way of oozing out of Wisconsin and I can't be running all over North America trying to get this stuff. And it's very difficult. It's difficult to ship. So 2 weeks ago, I placed a collection of Ethiopian birds that someone had in Kansas, and they were coming up to visit a relative in Sun Prairie, and I met them on the highway, transferred the birds, took them to the museum, and they were happy to have them. But, you know, of all things, Ethiopian songbirds, they were some strange-looking birds. But, you know, we're trying to make this a productive effort on both ends, both helping people essentially move the stuff out of a home where it's not wanted or needed anymore to someone who wants it. So,
and I brought up schools because one of my vivid memories from grade school one was a stuffed rough grouse that I looked at and you know, it had the big air sac up and I got to talk to the teacher about that, and she had done, you know, work. And the other was a beaver skull, where she would, you know, you could pull the teeth out, and she mm-hmm. talked about how they had to keep using yeah. those teeth yeah. because look at how large they are. Well, I was probably in second grade, and I still remember that. So I think for schools, it's a great opportunity.
Well, I think that's the thing to remember, is that these specimens, while they may have been obtained as hunting trophies or whatever, have a real educational purpose. I just believe, as you pointed out, you can't learn about constantly growing incisor teeth without actually seeing one. And
yeah.
So they have a place in outdoor education, and that's what we're trying to facilitate. So if we can make it happen for some materials, then I'm going to keep giving it a try. But I don't know what to do with all those specimens in Miami, which include a couple elephants.
Oh, my goodness.
Those are a little out of my reach. So anyway, that's what all I wanted to say.
How have people been getting a hold of you?
I have no idea. Well, email mostly.
Email.
Email. So they're finding, and the email usually starts out, I discovered your contact. I don't know what they're Googling or searching, but somehow I pop up, and the message starts out, I found your name on the internet as being someone who could help me place this specimen, that specimen, this collection, and then we go from there.
Yeah, very interesting.
It is very interesting.
Well, Annette in Green Bay has something interesting for us, too, I bet. Let's go there. Hi, Annette.
Well, hi there. Let's segue back to a living animal.
Okay.
We were fortunate to have a family of foxes find a home this early this spring in a big brush pile on our property, and we've been watching them and enjoying them, and they're just a joy. They're just so much fun. But now it's the grasses and everything's growing up, and we haven't seen them that much anymore. So I'm wondering what is their life cycle? Do they hang around? Will they come back? Will the pups go somewhere else? Will mom and dad start another family?
Yeah.
Just curious in general what we might expect.
Yeah, so they certainly will start dispersing on their own. They don't typically hunt, you know, they're more mousers, so hunting small mammals, small rodents, so don't really need to hunt in a pack for larger animals. But those kits will disperse and set up their own territories. And by next January, February, when breeding season rolls around, they'll be looking for mates and looking for a den site. As far as the den location itself, that pair could perhaps have a den again in that general area. Could be in the same location, but my experience having watched a couple dens over the years is that they've been like in the same mile section, but not in the exact same
spot.
Location. They haven't used the same den again. And part of that probably parasites, and you've got feces around there where they're choosing a new den site each year. So January, February breeding time, about 2 months gestation. So March, April, they're having their young again, you know, a handful of kits and feeding them in the den, and then they start exploring, and that's why you're not really seeing them along with the vegetation getting higher, but they're out and more on their own at this time of year.
So there you go, Annette. Thank you very much for calling. Holly in Ogama has something for us, too. Hi, Holly.
Yes, I picked up a raven or a crow, so my first question is, what's the difference between the two? And I want to give thumbs up to the Minocqua Rehab Center, who met me halfway in Tomahawk yesterday to pick the bird up, to check for West Nile and so forth. And my other question is if the bird has West Nile, is the animal able to be saved, etc.? That's all.
All right. Thank you, Holly. So the bird's still alive, in other words. It just seemed to be injured.
Sounds like it's alive, obviously, but I'm surprised that when they picked it up, someone didn't mention to her whether it was a crow or a raven. Yeah. But, I mean, they're both large black birds, but a raven is much more massive than a crow, and they have a huge bill relative to the proportion of the head and whatnot. And if they're alive and you hear them squawk, a raven call, you know, we were listening to grouse drumming and other things, but up at our cabin in Price County, I just love to hear the ravens occasionally.
Too.
But odds are, just because of abundance, crow would be more likely. I think a raven is so large and has such a large bill that she would have noticed that. But in any event, if it does have West Nile, I'm not sure there's anything they can do to treat it. I don't know, Jamie.
Yeah, I don't know about the treatment. They can probably treat symptoms. I think animals are able to survive having West Nile, obviously. But that's probably a better question for those licensed rehabilitators.
There you go. Thank you so much, Holly. I want to turn to some emails. By the way, we have open lines now, so we can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We had Ed from Waupun emailed a photo of a snake going across a, looks like a gravel road, looks like a pretty long one, and wonders what the heck it is. Well,
I'm just holding the picture out.
Jamie's
for Scott.
Jamie's made her identification, but just check it here while she's...
See if we agree.
Yep.
So it's a long snake. It's got a pattern. What would you call it? The pattern of
It has some blotches. It doesn't have the stripes, so not one of the garter snakes. Has a copper color to the head, but it is not a copperhead. We don't have those in Wisconsin, but it looks like a fox snake, or a lot of folks will refer to it as a pine snake. One of the harmless snakes in the state, feeding on lots of rodents.
Yeah.
Pretty common.
Yep. That was my guess, too. but I wanted to wait and hear what you had to say. There's another photo. Diane emailed some photos that if you take a look there, she took these photos from a snapshot camera on the Hurley School property. Is it a coyote or a wolf? I'm saying coyote, but what do you think? Just looking at the head.
I think it's a coyote. The head doesn't look broad or massive enough,
right,
and the ears short and round enough to be a wolf. It looks like a relatively slender, small animal. So,
although it could be a young,
could be a young wolf, but
I'll tell you what, their fur bearer specialists and carnivore specialists are getting pretty darn good at identifying between the two. I mean, you could reach out to the snapshot team and ask them, they can refer it on. But that's one of those pictures you send around a room and you get a mix of answers. So, and you can't quite see the bottom half of the animal. But coyotes are going to look leaner. They're going to have pointed ears. Their snout seems more slender. And a wolf in general, just a really large animal, more blunt faced.
Let's take another call. Phil in Madison, your turn. Hi, Phil.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, you're talking about the grouse, if anybody's ever made a correlation between turkeys and grouse and turkeys taking or reducing. Well, I saw where the turkeys went into a grouse nest and ate all the eggs, tore them all up or whatever. And I grew up in Grant County. And we used to have wonderful grouse hunting all the times I grew up, through the 70s and the 80s. But once the turkey showed up, all of a sudden grouse population started to diminish. And now I haven't seen a grouse on our farm in 10 years, and I've got turkeys coming out of my ears. So,
so Phil, first of all, that's probably one of the most common questions folks who work with grouse or turkeys get. And both Scott and I are involved in some workshops where we're working with private landowners to manage their properties for wildlife. And this observation comes up a lot, where we've seen the turkey population after the reintroduction efforts just boom. We've got turkeys in every county of the state. Populations are doing really, really well. And on the other hand, we see grouse, especially in the southwestern part of the state in the Driftless area where you're talking about, where those populations have really declined over time. But when you talk to the biologists and you look at where they nest, what they eat, you know, grouse are budding. Turkeys don't typically spend time foraging in the trees. So there's not been a lot of evidence to say they're competing for nest locations or food sites. Your observation of or report of turkeys eating a grouse nest, that has certainly been documented. Is it to the level where they're affecting their population? We haven't seen that. Turkeys are going to be opportunistic foragers like many animals. And so they come across a nest and they're probably going to take advantage of it, but not to the point where it's solving or reducing the overall population of grouse. I think most of the research, and there's been some excellent research done by Scott Walter, who was previously at UW-Richland Center and now works for the Department of Natural Resources, but research that shows predation and also more importantly than even predation is habitat fragmentation and habitat loss. So in aging of the forest, from where you're talking about growing up and in Grant County, we have a more mature forest that certainly favors turkeys over grouse. And then also the fragmentation. So grouse, the hens that they were following with telemetry, so they had captured hens and had telemetry equipment put on them and followed them, they really have to go through traversing a landscape that is very patchy, and that puts them at risk for predation. So it's thought more that there are habitat and other dynamics going on rather than a direct competition between those two species.
Scott, you're going to be giving a couple of talks actually on turkeys, are you not?
Yes, I'll put a quick plug in. This coming Saturday morning, I'll be at the Wild Birds Unlimited store on Old Sauk Road, west side of Madison, and doing two talks, more or less back to back, one at 10 for an hour, one at 11:30 for an hour on we'll be talking turkey all things about wild turkeys and answer questions. And I'll have some artifacts and so forth to show people. And We usually have a good time at those talks. So I think the first one at 10 is full, and there's still a few slots left at the ladder program at 11:30. If anybody's interested, they need to call the Wild Birds Unlimited store and reserve a spot.
There you go.
And I'll see some listeners then on Saturday.
Yeah, I hope you do. I bet you will. Scott Craven and Jamie Nack, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven and Jamie Nack. Scott's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Jamie is UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Take some more calls. Dan Small with us next. Hi, Dan.
Dan, your show here, and I have two comments. I heard a fellow asking about getting started in grouse hunting, and the Ruff Grouse Society is actually holding a first ever grouse camp for anyone interested, but it's mainly aimed at new hunters, and it's going to be held at Trees for Tomorrow up in Eagle River, September 27th through the 29th, and you can get information on it. It's not that expensive. And it involves some seminars and then at least one day in the woods and a second day optional in the woods for Saturday and Sunday. You can get information at their website, ruffedgrousesociety.org. To find it, you click on events and scroll down to Wisconsin. So you got to do a little digging, but it's there. It's called Grouse Camp. And then the other comment, Scott, regarding all of your taxidermy mounts, a mutual friend of ours, Mark LaBarbera, you may know this already, and maybe you've already given him some of your mounts, but he puts on the Midwest Outdoor Heritage Education Expo in May, and he has two trailers. He calls them Touch of the Wild trailers, and these are trailers with everything from squirrels to tigers in them. And he gets mounts donated by pretty much the same kind of people you get mounts from. And the kids can touch them, and he's always looking for new mounts because they wear the fur and the feathers off. So,
Dan, are those the trailers that the Conservation Congress folks are involved with too? Or two different things?
Yeah, I think they're involved with one of the trailers. He has them at his home in Hazel Green, and okay. They are out all over the state. We had one at Deerfest last weekend. He had one, I can't tell you where they all were, but they are available. And for folks interested in actually getting one of those trailers at an event, you can go to Outdoor Heritage Education Center. It's either .com or .org, I've forgotten, but contact him there. But I know he's always looking for mounts.
Okay, great. The Conservation Congress folks who are involved, and they may be the same thing, maybe not, are coming to pick some things up. But I'll reach out to Mark and anything I can move from one point to point A to point B is a good thing. So thanks very much, Dan.
Dan, thanks a lot, and thanks for that info on the grouse camp too. That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm going to be there actually, going to be recording it for Outdoor Wisconsin. And
cool.
So, yeah, it'll be a fun event. And speaking of mounts, Mark is actually looking for a taxidermist who might be willing to donate the mounting of, I've been live trapping raccoons and freezing them because they're bothering my chicken coop. And so I've got several of all ages and genders in my freezer right now. If you know or if anyone out there knows a taxidermist who wants to donate the mounting of, one raccoon or a whole family, you guys know how to get a hold of me. So
there you go. Dan Small, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. Wow, good information there from Dan. He was just on the program a couple of months ago. We were and had a lot of fun talking with him. Scott in Plover will give you a chance. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Lately I've been having a pigeon hanging around my house. Likes to come in the garage. eats from my hand, very friendly, and just wondering if there's anything to be concerned about, or just what's going on with this pigeon.
Maybe a home.
Well, it's healthy. There, this turns up occasionally, and the usual or most common explanation is that this is a homing pigeon, racing pigeon, somebody's pigeon that has made a wrong turn in life and ended up in your garage. First question usually is, does it have any bands on it, on its legs?
No, it doesn't. Okay, I was looking, you know, but yeah,
that doesn't necessarily change anything. It could still be a bird that was part of a race or a homing exercise or whatever. And without any identifier, you're not going to find the owner. And in my experience with trying to place these over the years, there's a Four Lakes Pigeon Club, for example, and some others around the state. And generally speaking, the response I got was, you know, if one of our pigeons disappears, then that's not a good pigeon. We just so wherever it is, we wish it a happy, healthy life, but we don't necessarily want it back. So I think you can befriend it. I don't know that there are any health issues you need to be concerned about. So you can either consider it a semi-wild pet or let it go, keep the garage closed up and let it go its way.
Yeah, there you go, Scott. Thank you so much for calling. And Al in Presque Isle, it's your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi. You were mentioning the grouse population and the drumming cones earlier, and I just want to let you know that I'm a trail runner and probably run about 40 miles a week around the trails of mostly Vilas County, but a little bit in Gogebic and Michigan and Iron. And my observations are that the grouse populations are way up. I'm seeing broods everywhere. And it's very encouraging after what we've been seeing the last several years. So, and that's something, you know, I kind of pay a lot of attention to as I'm running because I do enjoy the grouse.
Oh.
Well, and it sounds like you cover a fair amount of territory. So that's almost
that's good.
A trend survey, you know, from year to year. But, yeah, the drumming surveys are up. Now mm-hmm. we've got a couple anecdotal comments about broods and numbers of animals or birds. So we'll see what the fall brings.
I think we should do some research on that, Gary. Maybe, Larry, maybe he would put mark a map with the location of those broods, and we could check it out.
Oh, I do love it. It's about the best-tasting bird there is. They love grouse. They are a wonderful bird to observe and also to hunt and eat.
To consume, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Al. Appreciate it. Steve emailed to ask if work is being done on field test kits for CWD. He found it interesting. There's a test kit for West Nile. And additionally, any updates on CWD in Wisconsin, what's happening? We may not be able to cover it all before our news break, but what about test kits?
Just a really quick comment. So there was a two-day meeting by Department of Natural Resources, tribal agencies, conservation groups, again, just a few weeks ago, involved about maybe 10 different states, trying to get folks together to decide what priorities are and work in more of a multi-state collaborative in terms of preventing and controlling chronic wasting disease. And they set and established some priorities that the group was interested in, and one of them was expanded research into testing. And so they're really interested in methodologies that don't require lymph node material, so and also the desire to develop a live animal testing method. So it's certainly on the radar in terms of a high priority research need in terms of chronic wasting disease.
Yeah, it'd be really cool if they could
a litmus test, right? Wouldn't that be
blood
amazing?
Test or yeah. something that would be a very easy and simple to do for sure. So that was the main point, eh?
Yep, and then also other priorities were to evaluate management plan actions, so looking to see if efforts in various states have been effective in controlling CWD, so an evaluation of techniques or methodology, and then a pledge to kind of enhance and increase the collaboration on management and communication among states and tribal members and organizations and so on.
Interesting so, parties, yeah.
Yep.
Scott, you were talking about earlier about those that taxidermist work in Florida, and you're going to be in Florida. You've got an Everglades tour coming up, haven't you?
Yes. The tour will be from February 25th to March 1st. It's being run by Door County Nature Tours. I've done this one with my good friend Paul before. We have a great time in Southwest Florida. Start out in Fort Myers, work our way down to Lover's Key State Park, a beautiful spot south of Fort Myers, do a little shelling, sit on the beach, head for the Everglades for 3 days, take the tram through Shark Valley, do a wet walk in Big Cypress, whole bunch of other stuff. If people would like to get on the email list for this, do it quickly. We're only looking for 14, 15, 16 people. Email Door County Paul, all one word, doorcountypaul@gmail.com. Get yourself on the list because I don't think the spots for this particular tour will last very long. End of February, what better time to be in Florida and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, for sure. And so it's doorcountypaul@gmail.com.
That's correct.
Right?
Yep. And it'll be a fun trip. I'll be there with. I've done it before. We had a terrific time. I'm really looking forward to it. So Paul and I will be there to help everybody out and show them around.
Scott Craven, one of our guests today. Jamie Knack, the other. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with our two guests, Jamie Knack and Scott Craven. Jamie is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Scott's an emeritus professor from that department and with UW Extension as well. So, wildlife questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us your photos, wildlife photos, and questions to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Vivian in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I've a camera, and I have caught a possum over a several week period. And at one point, it dawned on me that the activity under her belly were the babies in the pouch. And over time, really, her pouch got so full, she just had to waddle around. But at one point, she came back, and there was just one baby apparently reluctant to leave. And then next visit, she had no babies with her. What happens to the young when they leave the pouch? Do they leave her, or does she sort of nest them somewhere so she can return to foraging?
Scott,
what
do you think?
I mean, first of all, you were pretty lucky to capture that on your cameras. That's a pretty neat thing. Possums are an interesting part of our fauna for a whole variety of reasons that you seem to understand. They're marsupials, they have a pouch, and all that. In terms of what happens, you know, most people's opportunity to see young is when they're actually kind of hanging on to the female, riding on her back or whatever. But they don't necessarily do that all the time, especially as they get larger. The weight burden is just too much. Excuse me. So assuming no ill fate occurred for these young, I think the female's leaving them somewhere on their own while she may be out foraging, and then return to them. And if there was a late departure from the pouch, then one may still be visible. So there's no way to tell exactly what's happened, but I don't think just because you're not seeing the young now, you need to assume that some unfortunate fate has befallen them. They're probably still around, and I think you'll detect that when you start to see half-grown possums turning up on your camera here over the next few weeks.
There you go, Vivian. Thank you for calling. Ellen in Eau Claire. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is, recently we live in a wooded area. We've been hearing an owl during the daytime hours. They were nocturnal.
Well, the majority of the owls are nocturnal. I would say snowy owls, which wouldn't be here at this time, are probably more crepuscular in nature, can be active more during the day. But the owls that are likely to be common in your area, barred owls, great horned owls, screech, saw-whet owls, they typically are active at night. They're one of the earliest nesting birds, so they're sitting on nests when there's often still, and they're typically a cavity nester or a broken-off tree and nest on the top of that. But anyway, they are nesting a lot of times when there's snow on the ground. So what could be happening is you still have young of the year in the area in a family group that they're still communicating with each other. And the other potential is there's a different animal that you're mistaking it for an owl.
Yeah, that's a possibility too.
Possibility, but you know, barred owls and great horned owls, I think you get pretty used to what the, you know, what those sounds are. But if you're hearing some more noise between multiple owls, it could be a family group that's communicating and still in the area as a unit.
There you go. Thank you so much, Ellen, for calling. Jim in Mauston, what's on your mind?
Hi, Scott, Jamie, and Larry. Well, I have a story about grouse hunting. Having grown up in Iowa and shooting pheasants all the time, it's kind of like shooting a barn door versus a lightning bolt. But I was hunting with my English setter, and we were in a little rock bed, and she got her nose into a cavity in a couple of the rocks. And when she pulled out, she had a bunch of porcupine quills in her nose. And not having seen many porcupines in Iowa, I thought I'd pull them out, which I did pull them out anyway, but I put a couple in my vest pocket. And within, I suppose, a few hours, I felt a couple pricks underneath my my bicep, and I noticed one, and I pulled that out. But about a week later, I was doing my rounds, and I saw a little lump kind of inching up towards my armpit. And I figured, geez, that's a porcupine quill. So it had started to move from about my elbow, about almost up to my shoulder. I went into a doctor's office, and he was going to pull it out. But he had two nurses there, too, and it seemed like he was almost in awe trying to pull that porcupine quill out because it had a little, you know, a little curve on the end of it. And the nurses' mouths were just gaped open, and they couldn't believe the doctor with the pliers pulling the porcupine quill out. So, story there. Don't pick up porcupine quills and put them in your pocket.
Oh, good story. Thanks, Jim, very much.
Yeah, I was going to say, porcupine quills with dogs are, I've had some experience with that ourselves, and quills can travel through their body, and you're still picking them out, you know, weeks later, whether it be in a paw or in the mouth area and so on. But they really can travel throughout the body.
Well, it's an interesting story, Jim. Probably not one you want to repeat the experience, but
a lesson learned.
It's a lesson learned. Thank you so much. Yeah. Pat in Oregon, we'll go to you next. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. I'm wondering about Asian carp in Lake Michigan or possibly Green Bay. Just finished reading the book about life or death and life of the Great Lakes. And wonder if you could give me an update. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling.
I think you're better off, Pat, with either that book or a little bit of work on the internet to find out what the current situation is. It's a little out of our wheelhouse as a fish, but I mean, from what I see, there's still a lot of effort being made to try and keep them out of the Great Lakes to the extent they can, with barriers along the Illinois River and other places where they're way too common. And beyond that, I just can't tell you much about the current situation.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. There's all kinds of talk about spending $1 billion, up to $1 billion, to keep them out of the Great Lakes.
Right.
So it's one of those things that you just hope it's not going to happen, but it could. And if it happens, once it happens, it's not going to be a good thing.
Yeah,
that's for sure. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. JJ in Door County emailed. He's been a waterfowl hunter all his life. Over the past 3 to 4 years, he's noticed snow geese making their way through northeast Wisconsin in the fall. He'd never noticed snow geese in the area before and wonders, are the populations just getting so large that they're expanding their range more east of the Mississippi? Any studies or any information on that?
Well, there are two things. The first point is that, yes, snow goose populations are still just going crazy, and hunting doesn't seem to have put much of a lid on it, and no one really knows what else to do. But there's a lot more concern further west of us in the heart of their range and up in the Hudson Bay lowlands and areas where they nest, where they're causing major problems to that environment. So they are occasionally seen in Wisconsin, probably more frequently now than they used to be. But you have to be a little bit cautious. Jim says he's a longtime waterfowl hunter, so I assume he knows. But I think folks who are perhaps not quite as experienced, what you do see quite a few flocks of now that are big white birds with black wingtips are white pelicans. And those have become way more common, and we've had big flocks of them near where I live, south of Madison, on some of those wetlands, particularly in the spring, but you also see them in the fall. So one has to be a little cautious about what you're actually looking for, and I see that
John
leads into another call here that mentions white pelicans. So.
John in Green Bay, let's go to you. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. In late July, we had a cottage up in the Land O'Lakes area of northern Ballas County. In late July, we had a white pelican show up on our lake. And, you know, after 50 years in Ballas County, that's really an unusual bird. We see a lot of them down here in the Green Bay area, but never saw one up north. I guess I'm just wondering how common they are up there.
Well, they're not, as you've pointed out, and I spend a lot of time in the Minocqua area and Price County and whatnot. I've never seen one up there, but an individual bird, there's no knowing for sure. It could have been injured or sick and dropped out of a flock passing through. It might have been caught up in a thunderstorm and blown off course and separated from the flock. You can conjure up a whole host of hypothetical explanations, but the world of birding and bird world is built around these accidentals, as they're called, when a bird that shouldn't be in a certain place shows up for whatever reason and then generates a lot of interest. So it's a cool thing to see, but in terms of how it got there, why it was there, or what happened to it, it's all speculation.
All speculation. But who knows?
Who knows?
Maybe that we're going to see more of them up there. We had Deborah from Verona email that she's been biking with friends in Springfield Corners area in July, saw some sharp-tailed grouse along the side of the road. Sharp-tails. They seem pretty tame. One even ran alongside one of us for a while. She's guessing they were bred at a nearby farm. Are they native to that area?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm guessing she meant to say rough grouse. So the sharp-tail are in the northwestern part of the state, not a very large population. In fact, as we give that fall hunting forecast, they opted to close the sharp-tail grouse hunting season for the fall. But getting back to the rough grouse, if that is in fact what she saw, every year I would say there's a couple of stories that we get reports of or emails where some rather tame grouse are either following somebody along on, they start up their tractor and all of a sudden there's a grouse following them around their woodlot or bicycle and so on. So there's certainly been a lot of very interesting stories about grouse on people's properties that have taken an affinity or have been very tame in appearance.
And if it was a sharp-tail, Scott, would it have come from a game farm?
Grouse are very difficult to raise in captivity, and we hear lots of things in the program, but this is one where I think sharp-tailed grouse is a long shot. I'll offer up an alternative theory that what she saw was a brood of pheasants, which would at that time of year look more like a sharp-tailed grouse, and would be relative. First of all, they'd be together, whereas some of these other birds wouldn't be, and she said she saw a number of them. So I think it was a case of alternative identity. The sharp-tailed grouse are at the point where there's not even going to be any kind of a season on them this year, and the remnant populations are way up in the northwestern part of the state.
It should have been a hen pheasant with an older brood by July.
Yeah, could well have been.
Who knows?
Clint in Duluth, Minnesota. We go to you next. Hi, Clint.
Oh, good afternoon or good morning. I just wanted to report on a canoe trip last year up in the Boundary Waters. We were by Lake Insula, which has been burned over from the Bakami Creek fire. And we heard this sound that we thought must have been some type of frog, because there aren't a lot of trees there. And the only, we never did see it, and there were a couple of them. And what it turns out to be is the call is identical to a boreal owl. And I'm wondering if that's possible.
Well, let's listen to Dave Potratz has one for us. Clint, that's a boreal owl call. Is that what you heard?
That's what we heard, and we thought it was frogs, because we heard it mostly in the evening, and of course the wind is calmer then. I was trying to teach my granddaughters different aspects of the wilderness, but that stumped us until we got home and went through our Sibley Bird app, and that was identical to what we heard.
Well, let's listen to it once more. That's pretty cool.
Mystery solved. I think we put that in the win column.
I mean, are there boreals that come this far south? Or,
yeah, I'm looking at a range map here, and you know, boreal, they're going to reach the northern tier of counties in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So, you know, certainly a possibility. Another one to check out or to call up on that app would be to look at the northern saw-whet owl as being a similar species.
Kind of call.
Maybe not in call, but at least in, I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
Yeah. No, he didn't have a chance to see it,
but he heard
it, and he's pretty sure that it was a boreal. So that is...
Yeah, it's possibility to be kind of towards the southern end of their distribution range.
Thanks a lot for calling, and thanks for that story. That's a great story. That's a wonderful place. I don't know if either of you have spent any time in that part of the world.
Yeah, we spent a week this summer up in Ashland and Bayfield, and yeah, it's a pretty area.
Very, very pretty area. Scott, I want to go back to you for a minute. And by the way, if you have a question, there might still be a time for a call or two at 800-642-1234. But that Everglades tour, I want to go back to that, Scott, because people are, you know, wondering a little bit more details on it.
Well, it's the 2020 Everglades tour run by the Door County Nature Tour operation. A good friend of mine I've known for a long time. I accompanied him on this trip 2 years ago. We had a terrific time. I think there were 14 of us, and as I mentioned earlier, we start out on the 25th of February in Fort Myers, Florida. Easy place to get to, beautiful little airport. And then move from Fort Myers down to Everglades City, stay in a really nice place in Everglades City, and then that's the base of operations for a couple tours of units of the Everglades. And we'll see lots of gators, big gators. Everybody wants to see a python, but we've not run into one of those yet on the trip. But we hit some really nice restaurants. We hit at some really nice beaches. We try and offer during that 6 days a really good taste of what it's like to be in Southwest Florida and watch the news every night and see what the weather looks like in Green Bay, Wisconsin, or some other northern point. And then everybody smiles, and we go back to the beach and watch the sunset. So it's
Now, do you fly together, or is everybody responsible?
Everyone meets in Fort Myers.
Okay.
And it's well-serviced by all the major airlines. I usually fly through either Detroit or Atlanta, and only one stop. And we'll meet in Fort Myers, spend a night there, and then we'll have a couple of vans. I'll drive one, Paul will drive the other one, and we head south. We hit Corkscrew Swamp, the famous Audubon Society sanctuary, several other nature areas, and
It sounds like a lot of fun.
It's just a great getaway. So that's February 25th to March 1st. And if people are interested, email Door County Paul. Door County Paul, all one phrase, at gmail.com. And do it. This is kind of like these ads on TV. Do it now because it won't. But we're only talking about, usually it's couples, and we're only talking about seven or eight couples, and the thing's going to be filled up. The reason Paul wants it emailed is because he can establish a list of when the emails come in, and then it's basically first come, first serve. So, and he has a file. He'll send out a file to anyone who sends in an email with a detailed itinerary, what we're going to do, why, when, where, all that stuff. So it'll be fun.
And I see the DNR has a new website design for its Go Wild program. Have you seen
it? I have not been on it. I did purchase licenses back in March, but if it was new then, it was seamless.
It looked really, really, I mean, that's when I was last on it, too. It looked really wonderful. So it may be the same one. And, Scott, I wanted to go one more thing. As long as you're promoting things, you've got a talk coming up at the Wild Birds Unlimited in Madison.
Yes, this coming Saturday, I think that's the 10th. 10 o'clock in the morning, another one at 11:30. I think the 11:30 one's the only one that has openings. We talk about wild turkeys, and they have a nice setup there. We have a good time, and I suspect those will be full quickly as well. So I'll see some folks on Saturday morning.
See some folks on Saturday mornings. And Jerry in Manitowoc, have you got a quick question or comment?
Just a comment. About a year ago, I was out trimming some bushes in my backyard, and I noticed that night I had an insect bite on my side under my shirt. Went to the doctor that next day because it was burning, and they gave me antibiotics. I went back the following day because it was bigger and larger, and they told me it was a brown recluse spider bite, and good thing I was on antibiotics, but they have moved up because of climate change.
Some reports of it, although sometimes even the doctors are mistaken when it comes to a particular bite. I know from Phil Pelletieri being on the show, the way the wound opens up after the fact is more of a giveaway of whether or not it's a brown recluse spider or not, because it opens up into a kind of an open wound, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think you probably have more to add to it from listening to Phil. But, Jerry, that's a little out of our wheelhouse as well. But for more information, either look online or contact the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison and talk with PJ Leash.
There you go. And we are out of time. Scott, Jamie, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Larry.
Thanks. Scott, you're back on September 4th, Wednesday.
We'll work that out. I think that Jamie and David were going to be back that time because I've been on for three. Anyway, we'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Somebody will be here on
the first Wednesday of the month for sure. Scott Craven and Jamie Nack, great to have them with us. And great to have you listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.